the church bells chime. It's harvest time.
From the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media, welcome back to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the science behind weather and climate in Illinois. Today, we're talking all about fall weather. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Trent Ford, state climatologist at the Prairie Research Institute.
To talk more about those vibrant fall colors, we are joined by Christy Rowlandson, senior scientist of forest ecology at the Morton Arboretum near Naperville, Illinois. Thank you for joining us, Christy.
Happy to be here. Always happy to talk about fall color.
All right. So, Christy, you know, before we get into that, what do you do in your role as scientist at the Morton Arboretum?
I am a research scientist, so that means it is my job to ask questions and then figure out how to answer them and then try to answer them. But being at the Morton Arboretum, we don't just do the research. We make sure that the research gets out to those that can use it. So we work with different groups in the region to understand how what we're seeing with their trees, particularly with how weather is impacting trees, is my specialty. What that means for what kind of trees we should plant, what kind of care we should give them, as well as things we should be looking at towards the future.
And Christy, how did you first get excited about this area of research?
So I grew up in the Appalachians. My county was almost all forested, much of which was national forest. And so the rhythm of the seasons just kind of really drove everyday life. In the fall, it was always one of my favorite times. The weather gets cooler. The mountains are just an explosion of color. It's also kind of when a lot of other rhythms change. So hunting being a big thing, additional management for the forest. And so thinking about those seasonal cycles always mean particular things, both to people and the biology of the tree. And so what I've always found interesting is that no two falls are ever the same. The timing changes from year to year. Some of the color changes from year to year. And there are biological reasons for that. And so what motivates my interest in a lot of my fall color research is what does, how fall color plays out this year tell us about how the tree behaved, how well it grew over the course of a given year? But then more importantly, what does it tell us about the tree's resilience going into the future? And so I don't have all the answers to that, but they're the kind of these two parts, which is one, describing the patterns, and then two, figuring out why that happens so that we can figure out what it means moving forward.
And so a segue into this topic is the why. What causes the leaves to turn bright colors that we see in the fall?
Yeah, so there's always kind of two ways to answer this question. One is, why do the leaves change color in the first place? And the simple answer is because they can't keep them in the winter. Most of the leaves that are changing, they're all relatively thin. And if those leaves were to be on the tree in the winter, the cells would literally explode as the water inside of them freezes. It's like putting a water bottle into your freezer that's a little too full. As the water expands, you can break your water bottle. And so what happens in a tree is those cells expand and get permanently damaged. And all of that investment of energy and resources into the leaves falls. It's the same reason that we worry about a late frost in the spring, but it's just kind of that other end of the season. And so many trees have evolved to like, oh, we know that winter is going to be inhospitable for growth. So let's just shed these expendable appendages. Let's get what resources we can back and try again. So the other part is like, why do they change color? And that is really fun because except for red, which we can talk about in a second, the color isn't as much like something new being produced, but actually the breaking down of the green in the leaves, because the green chlorophyll, where all the energy from the sun is being harnessed, it requires a lot of energy to produce, and also particularly nitrogen. And so rather than lose that nitrogen, put it into the soil where a tree has to compete with other organisms to get it again the next year, it's able to resorb it, store it in other tissues. And so as that green is broken down, other colors come forward, particularly yellows, which are a pigment called carotenoids that are in other structures of the tree. And then some plants will also produce a red pigment, anthocyanin, to help protect other chemicals as this senescence process occurs.
So I'm curious, so you said that some of the chlorophyll gets stored in other parts of the plant. Where does it get stored?
That is a good question. We know some of it is put into the roots. Roots are buffered from a lot of the environmental variation we see above ground. We also know that some is in twigs and in what we call non-structural carbohydrates, which is just kind of like an internal special juice that the tree can remobilize. And so that's something that people are actively looking at by measuring these compounds in different tissues, trying to understand where do trees always put this energy, and then how do they remobilize it when they can start growing again?
So then we have fall, and we have the leaves turning colors, depending on the species, as the trees sort of understand. I don't know if I understand, we don't put it that way, but sense that winter is coming. So how does weather impact when the leaves turn colors and when they fall?
Yeah, so the classic ecology answer here is it depends and it's not well understood. We do know that weather has an impact on the timing of fall color because it's not the same every year. But we also know that there's a combination of factors, and it's not just weather that causes or determines the timing of fall color. In general, the things that trigger the beginning of senescence and that fall color to appear, environmental cues, a big one is day length. So these things that mean that the tree won't be able to keep growing. So day length is absolutely one cue, but that doesn't vary from year to year. So that's clearly not the entire picture. There's increasing research on how much that timing of fall color is influenced by the day-to-day conditions this time of year versus what also happened earlier in the season. And so the growing season in general, how much a tree was able to grow does seem to play a role. There's some emerging research that's consistent with other studies about in a dry summer, that's not a great growing season, trees tend to senesce a little on the early side. But then the fall conditions, particularly how cold is it getting at night, how much water has the tree given, seem to really impact some of that timing. And so if you have favorable conditions, it can extend it later. In general, in much of the eastern and northeastern United States, a warm fall is associated with later fall color. In this region, we're seeing some emerging trends that dry weather is associated with slightly earlier fall color. And so it's this difficult balance, and it's kind of what makes each year a little different.
Are we seeing that now with our current drought? Because we have such dry conditions, are we getting more fall color in Illinois?
Yes and no. You know, I can't speak to the whole state of Illinois, especially as many of y'all haven't reached the point in which you normally expect to see fall color. Up in northern Illinois, this is right around the time where the color starts to more rapidly seep into the trees. We have seen some trees at the tree level, you know, dropping leaves early, dropping leaves without having fully senesced. The understory out in the woods is much barer than I typically associate for this time of year. But other species, things like our oaks, they're not showing any color change. And part of that is they normally wouldn't change color until mid-October or so, but they also tend to be a bit more drought resilient.
Just want to take a quick moment to say you're listening to Weather Realness. We're talking about fall colors with Christy Rowlandson, Senior Scientist of Forest Ecology at the Morton Arboretum near Naperville, Illinois. Yeah, and kind of on this topic, so you'll kind of notice that, you know, you say you're walking along the street you take to work, some trees are going to turn earlier than others. What determines which trees turn before others?
So like a lot of things in nature, it's really a combination of nature versus nurture. So in that nature thing, I'm talking about the kind of tree it is. And so its inherent genetic makeup, based off of how this tree has evolved to deal with its environment and avoid winter. And so there are some things that always change on the early side. There's a lot of edge species, like if y'all have sumac down there. Honey locust is a common street tree. It's got little leaflets that turn bright yellow about this time of year. Those are always among some of the earliest things to change. Maples almost always change earlier than oaks. And oaks are always on that later. So there's that species component that that means you'll have some similar trends across environments. However, within that species, different locations will change at different times. And in general, trees that are stressed or in highly exposed environments tend to change early. So that means that you will typically see the trees in the middle of the parking lot change color before the trees in the middle of the forest. And so that's because high light environments are associated with often brighter color, less moisture availability, these things that cause a tree to say, yep, time to give up and get ready for winter. Whereas in a forest, there's a lot more environmental buffering. The trees, you know, y'all are weather folks. They buffer it by like preventing the wind going through. So they will stay a little warmer at night, and they'll also trap some of that moisture in the system. And those are factors that contribute to them changing color a little later.
What about ginkgo trees? You know, ginkgos in the same, similar environments. I don't know. They seem to lose their leaves the same time. And I know they're dinosaur trees, so they're completely different than pretty much everything else we have around here. But are they the only species that seems to do this? And do we know why that tends to happen?
Ooh, that's a great question. Ginkgos are certainly the most well-known tree for doing this. For a lot of other trees, leaves will hang on until wind blows them off, honestly. So you will often see a lot of leaves fall at once from a tree, but nothing nearly as dramatic as ginkgos. Ginkgo drop day is something that some people really look out for. And what I really find fascinating about ginkgo is that synchronous drop happens almost every year, but it will also happen even if the trees don't turn completely yellow. A couple years ago on Halloween, we had the temperatures get down super cold at night and it snowed. And the ginkgos around here dropped their leaves green because they hadn't changed color yet. I don't know what exactly causes that. It might be a rapid formation of the scar tissue that forms at the base of a leaf this time of year. And that's actually what causes them to fall off. And then the other fun thing about a ginkgo is it's actually more closely related to pine trees than it is most of our other broadleaf trees. And so I don't know if that has anything to do with its internal coordination either. But yeah, ginkgos are so cool in that they do that synchronous drop and they've got that beautiful yellow color when they do so.
And Chris, you led us right into this one, but why don't evergreens like pine, you know, why don't those change color and why don't those leaves or pine needles eventually fall?
That goes back to kind of each individual species has evolved to deal with its environment differently. And so pines are, biologically speaking, as a group, much, much, much older than our broadleaf trees. But also a lot of these things that people associate with like the classic differences between a pine and an oak, many of those traits are adaptations to dealing with cold. So rather than having big, thin leaves, pines have needles. And so there's not a lot of surface area on it, which means that it's not going to be as prone to some of the environmental variation or damage from that variation that things with big, thin, and kind of energetically cheap leaves produce. Another big thing with that is their color. And so because they're dark and because of that structure, pine trees, speaking very broadly, including, you know, actual pines, spruces, firs, those kind of things, they are often pretty dark and they're native to really cold environments. And so up in like northern Canada and Alaska, when they do get sun, that canopy is able to kind of absorb and trap that heat and actually melt some of the snow underneath it. So it's able to create an environment that allows it to kind of squeak out some growth and capture some of that energy. And then kind of the third big thing, it has to do with that freezing of water. So pine trees and things that hang on to their leaves during extreme temperatures, they have that sap. And so one way they prevent, you know, those cells freezing and exploding is when they reinforce them. Needles tend to be really thick and really durable, so they have their cell walls reinforced. But then also that sap makes it harder for the water to like fully freeze in those cells. And so that allows it to kind of keep moving a little bit in what I call the buffer season. So a little further on either side than our deciduous trees are typically able to grow.
So Christy, so after we've had this, you know, beautiful color, the leaves have then fallen, do leaves serve a purpose after they've fallen on the ground?
Oh, absolutely. So this year's leaves are next year's soil. So this process of the leaves falling and decomposing, rotting on the ground is really essential for soil health in forests. So leaves that are shed, they are full of carbon. They still have some nutrients in them. And so what happens is they fall and then they I could nerd out a little bit about like different kinds of leaves will decompose in different ways. But in general, once they're on the ground, microbes and insects start chopping them up and doing that whole classic decomposition process. And the two big things that it gives to the soil are, some of it is texture. And before they decompose, leaves can be really important for insulating the ground against, you know, temperature variations. The soil under leaves will freeze much slower than soil that is fully exposed, bare soil. And so it will help hold on to moisture. It's basically, leaves are compost. And so if you apply compost or mulch to your garden, or even farmers do this, it's exactly all of those reasons. It put nutrients back in, it helps the texture, it helps it hold on to water. And so that's one of the key things that makes a forest soil different than like your yard is this massive input of what we call organic material every fall.
So let's go to the yard then. And this is starting to be the time of the year, and as we get into November, where you see lots of raking, maybe some burning, which just is a point. People should not be burning right now just because of drought issues. But is there an alternative? If I say don't want to or don't have the time to rake my leaves, what is the alternative to raking them to help out with the health of lawns, gardens, kind of the residential ecosystem?
Yeah, if you do choose to rake them, you can certainly put them in garden beds or pile them up and add them to a compost. I personally am lazy and haven't raked leaves in a long time, because what I personally do is I use the lawnmower to just chop them up. And so it helps prevent the leaves from forming a mat that will inhibit some of your grass growth, but it still recycles those nutrients into your yard so that it kind of stays on site. And so with this, it's always great to kind of minimize the waste and keep the system functioning by keeping many of these inputs on site. The one thing is just pay attention to whatever your local restrictions are, and make sure you do what you can to keep those leaves out of the grates in your street to help prevent flooding in your neighborhood.
That's all we've got time for. Thank you so much, Christy, for joining us.
Not a problem. Anytime.
Christy Rowlandson is a senior scientist of forest ecology at the Morton Arboretum. For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about Illinois weather and climate. Today, we're talking all about fall weather. So Trent, I want to switch gears a little bit from fall color to talk about another important fall weather event, the first frost, which typically marks the end of the growing season. So Trent, what causes frost in general?
Yeah, it's a good question. So if we think about dew first, so during the summer a lot, we'll come outside in the morning, there'll be dew all over the ground. What that is water that has condensed, meaning it's going from gas form in the atmosphere to liquid on the ground. And the reason that that dew's formed is that the temperature, the air temperature overnight or in the early morning, hit the dew point temperature, at which point the air is saturated. It can't hold as much water as it has, so it condenses it onto the ground. Frost forms through multiple ways, or can form through multiple ways, but instead of that temperature, that dew point temperature being above freezing, meaning the water forms as liquid, instead it's below freezing and it forms as ice, or kind of the frozen water in frost form. Now, there's multiple ways that frost can form. We think about it, the way that I just described is essentially the air cools overnight. We get a nice, of course, when the sun goes down, the temperature starts dropping. It gets to that frost point. The air is saturated, but it's also below freezing as far as temperature, near freezing, and we get that frost formation.
So, Trent, when does the first frost typically, when do we typically see that in Illinois?
Yeah, so it is really variable from year to year, but on average, we see the first fall frost in late September, early October in northern Illinois, and then we go about a week or two later for central Illinois and a week or two later for southern Illinois. So usually by the time we get to Halloween, on an average year, the entire state has had the end to the growing season and has seen its first fall frost. But again, I want to make the point that first fall frost does not mean first fall freeze, where the temperature actually gets below 32 degrees. So even if we have a night that only gets to 35, 36 degrees, we can still have frost. So when we look at the records about climatological, like first fall freeze, and if you look at the state, this is a shameless plug here, look at the state climatologist office website, you'll know that my maps say first fall freeze, not frost, because we don't necessarily know if there's frost or not just by air temperature alone. We actually have to visually see it, which is challenging.
Okay. But folks in ag are really interested in the frost because that kind of signals the end of their growing season.
Absolutely, yeah. So for commodity crops like corn and beans, we can see problems related to harvest, especially bean snap and things like that after we get that frost. But it's really more of a specialty crop, a vegetable and fruit growing thing, because that's when we do start to see some of those impacts. And certainly if we have an unusually early first fall frost, it can come at unexpected times when some different types of important crops like pumpkins, for example, may not be completely mature, and we can see damage. And certainly on the flip side, we can definitely see damage when there's a late spring frost as well.
Given how difficult it is to predict, about when could we expect the first frost in these different areas of Illinois that you talked about?
Yeah, so we talked about the climatological first fall frost. We have had some frost in far northern Illinois this year. It actually came fairly early. We had a pretty substantial cool snap maybe a better way to call it, in late August and early September. So we did have some frost in September, which isn't, again, necessarily rare for northern Illinois. We certainly haven't had anything in central and in southern Illinois yet. I would venture to say that this second week of October, we may see some more frost across northern Illinois, maybe some parts of central Illinois, like in the Illinois Valley, where you can get some cold air pooling, just because we do look at forecasts of temperatures getting down to the low 40s, which means they can really cool to the upper 30s.
Well, thank you, Trent. Appreciate your insight.
Yeah, thanks, Maddie.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover.
And I'm Trent Ford.
That's it for this week's episode. Next week on Weather Realness, we're talking about space weather. If you have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle, leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Weather Realness is produced by
Jeff Frame,
Trent Ford,
Steve Nesbitt,
Reginald Hardwick,
and myself, Maddie Stover. Funding for this podcast is partially provided by the Backlund Charitable Trust. Weather Realness is produced by the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media. We'll talk with you again next week.